This is Execution Watch, Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Mendoza to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out one-third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Merrill Pointier and Monique Sparks, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Snyder, and featured interview guest Jamila Hodge, CEO of Equal Justice USA. The Execution Watch for Moises Mendoza begins.
Tonight, the state of Texas ushers Moises Sandoval Mendoza into the death chamber. To our listeners around the world, thank you for joining us on this Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025 edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for Western World Radio on KPFT Houston, they will be back next week in their regularly scheduled 6 o'clock time slot. If you're not familiar with this show, Execution Watch was started by activists Ray Hill and Elizabeth Stein in 2008 and is produced by a dedicated staff of volunteers. We report live each and every time an execution is scheduled in the state of Texas. The live video stream can be found right now on our Execution Watch Facebook page and will be posted later on YouTube. We're going to have legal expert analysis as well as live reports from Huntsville and breaking news regarding any last-minute judicial action. Our featured interview tonight is going to be with Demetrius Minor. He is the executive director of Conservative Concerned, an organization seeking to reform the criminal justice system. The offer for a final interview with KPFT's Execution Watch was declined by Mr. Mendoza. Tonight, the state of Texas will execute Moises Sandoval Mendoza. Now age 41, Mendoza was convicted and sentenced to death for the murder of 20-year-old Rachel O'Neill Tolson on March 18, 2004, in Farmersville, Texas. Joining us first tonight is our reporter stationed just outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas, Linda Snyder. She's an anti-death penalty activist reporting from outside. But hello, Linda. Thank you for joining us.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Okay. They've already crossed. They're trying to get this execution on the road.
Why?
So they've already come across. I don't know why, but they've already crossed the road.
Now, Elizabeth had sent us something that said that there is an unusual police law enforcement presence there. Do we know why?
They said it's a state law that we cannot block the road with this traffic. And they said all kinds of stuff. We got a recording. Gloria and Danny recorded their ugliness. And they've got guns. And they've told us they're going to arrest us if we cross on the street. So we're in the parking lot. And that's where we have to stay.
That's an unusual situation. This has never happened before. Is that correct?
It's never happened, never. In all the years I've been, or any of us have been here, it's not happened. They were very rude. In fact, I thought they were going to handcuff a young lady that was with Abe's group because she refused to move. And they were getting their handcuffs set out ready to get her. She came over here.
Are there very many protesters there?
Let's see, there's one, probably about 25, I guess.
So that's a little bit unusual. It seems to be that the number is growing rather than, which is unusual, isn't it?
Yes, it's growing, yes. But the thing that bothers all of us is that this road should not be open on execution night because they should let us have our say. It's a peaceful demonstration. There's no reason why we can't have it peaceful, right?
Can you tell our listeners around the world how you know that the execution has begun? There is a signal that you look for. Can you explain that?
Right. We look for the signal for the witnesses to come out of the chamber, or not the chamber, but across the road from where the execution chamber is. And his wife, as soon as we saw his wife come out, we knew they were already going in.
So we know that Mr. Mendoza's wife will be present. Is that correct? Who else might be?
He's inside the chamber with him, yes.
Who else is standing witness? Do we have
any idea? As far as we know, there's no one else. Not just, as far as we know, it's just her.
So, Linda, is Danny Allen there with you at this point?
Yes, just a moment, I'll get her.
All right. Danny Allen is also an activist, along with Linda Snyder. They are the Death Row
Danny,
Angels.
Danny, you're on.
And they are,
Danny, you're on the radio.
Are very positive force for people who are on Death Row. They are not only, they do the other ministering work on a day-to-day basis. Danny Allen and Linda Snyder are also a part of the prison show, which airs on KPFT every Friday night from 9 until 11 o'clock. Danny, are you set up yet? We'll get back to her in just a second.
I am. I'm right here.
Danny.
I was just giving glory. No, I'm here.
Danny, tell us a little bit something about, I hear that you've been texting with Mr. Mendoza today. Can you tell us something? What do you know of Mr. Mendoza? Do you know him personally? And what were some of the things that you texted about today?
I do know him personally. He was actually best friends with my Billy, who was executed in 2020. That's how I got to know him. I visited him for a while, and then more of his family wanted to come see him. But today I've been talking on and off with his wife, Melanie, and I've been chatting on and off with him the past few days. The last message I got from him was saying that he loved me and he loved Billy. He was very sorry. He craved forgiveness. I do know that. I personally think he was scared. I don't know that for, 100%, but I do think he was scared.
Do you think he found that forgiveness anywhere?
I do think he found forgiveness with his family and especially his wife. His wife is Melanie. She was so sweet. She's been standing by his side for years. And I do think he found that forgiveness. As far as the victim's family, to my knowledge, he never had contact with them. And you know what? He also found forgiveness with a lot of the men there on death row and a lot of the men in prison, the field ministers, just the men from GP going in and out of death row. He found forgiveness. And, he was a lost soul for so long, but I think that his wife helped him. My Billy helped him. They helped each other.
Well, I know you still miss Billy. That's a hole that's never going to go away, and I'm still sorry for your loss on that. Danny, what do you tell people when you talk to them about this, the inevitability that tomorrow they will not be here with us? What do you say?
I mean, you can't say something cliche. I mean, because who wants to hear you're going to be in a better place? Who wants to hear that? I mean, I don't. There's nothing you can say to him or to his wife. I can't even imagine his mother, what his mother's going through. I do know that you feel alone. No one can make you feel better, no matter what. And I believe that he was scared. I mean, whether it be scared to leave his wife, scared to leave, they have a daughter, scared to leave his mother, his brother, his, you know, cousins, his friends. I think he was scared.
Let me ask you one more question, if I can, Danny. It seems, why are, in your opinion, are they rushing this? We usually don't see a crossing until 6:30 or so. Do you have any idea of why they're rushing the execution?
Absolutely, because the Supreme Court ruled, and I'm sorry, I put the camera right up to my face. Supreme Court ruled on it early.
Right.
And we do not see that very often, that they rule on it early. However, when you have attorneys like he did, there's nothing, you know, that he didn't get anything filed, hardly. He had a stay of execution that was denied by the CCA, but that was pretty much, I mean, yeah, if when the Supreme Court rules early, you generally see the witnesses walk at a little after six.
All right, so that does explain it. Thank you so much, Danny. I appreciate it. Please let Linda know to contact us again when they come out, if you don't mind.
Okay, she's right here. She heard. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Danny. That was Danny Allen and, of course, Linda Snyder, who are reporting from outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas. As we know, now the state of Texas is now beginning the lethal injection procedure that is going to end Moses' life. So let's talk a little bit about tonight's case. Tonight we welcome our special guests, criminal defense attorneys Meryl Pontier and Monique Sparks. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us today. Meryl, why don't you start and tell us a little bit about the case?
Meryl, I need to know when they come back across.
Sure. Maybe we can see if Linda can mute herself so we're not... Oh, there we go. Great. Okay. So Mendoza was convicted in 2005 for 2004 murder. It was a murder of a woman, and the state said that he took her from her home and where she left her baby behind. She was found murdered and sexually assaulted a couple weeks later. The police got to Mendoza as a suspect because apparently the day she was found, he told a friend that he did that, and the friend contacted the police, and the police arrested him, and he confessed to it. They had a trial during punishment phase. The state brought up several extraneous offenses, which were all assaults. So he got convicted, sentenced to death. He filed a direct appeal in 2008. He raised over 40 points of error. Amongst other things, he said there was not enough evidence to convict him. He also alleged or challenged the finding of future dangerousness. All of that was denied. And then his post-conviction, he filed his first application in 2009. He raised 7 claims, and what I found interesting was there was no evidentiary hearing held at the district court. You usually see that for a first writ application, especially in a death penalty case, that there will be an evidentiary hearing to decide on, you know, whether the claims have any merit. He was denied a hearing, so they just decided based on the applications that were filed. The CCA then also denied it. He then filed a federal habeas petition, which at first was dismissed in 2012. But in 2012, the Supreme Court also decided in an important ruling that if you want to raise an IAC claim for your state habeas counsel and you can show cause to proceed on an IAC claim that was otherwise defaulted by showing that your state habeas counsel was deficient when state habeas raised it in state court, then you can raise that IAC claim in federal court. And so Mendoza was actually represented by the same counsel in federal habeas as he was in state habeas, and that creates a conflict because the federal counsel is not going to raise an IAC claim about his own representation in state court. You know, if he represented him in state court and then in federal, and then now you have this possibility of raising an IAC claim on work that was done in state court, you're not going to do that if it's the same attorney. So usually what you see is the attorney who handles state appeals is not going to do the federal habeas. But in his case, it was the same attorney. So Mendoza asked for, he appealed the decision the federal court denied his application, and he said, I want new counsel so I can again raise an IAC claim because my state habeas counsel didn't do a good job. So he was actually given new counsel to file an IAC claim in federal court, and they found new evidence of false testimony and IAC during trial and in state court. Mendoza said that during his punishment phase, there was evidence that was used to show he was a future danger, which was that he had assaulted another inmate while he was awaiting his trial in jail. And a jail officer testified that Mendoza initiated that fight, that he started the fight. And his habeas counsel actually talked to this inmate, and the inmate said, no, I started the fight. And he wrote a declaration and said, I did it. And so Mendoza says, you know, the jail officer gave false testimony, and also the jury would not have found me a future danger had they known I did not initiate the fight. The federal court did not agree. They rejected it. He appealed it, and that was denied too. He then filed a cert petition in 2024, which was denied. And actually this month, he filed a subsequent habeas application, and he raised the same claim that he raised in federal court about the false testimony and the IAC claim in relation to that that fight in jail that he had, because he'd never raised it in state court. He had only raised that in federal court, so he raised it again in state court, and that was this month. But it was denied as an abuse of the writ, which is what you see when you file it, I guess you could say, too late. And so that's kind of an overview of his case and the procedural history.
Very interesting. Monique, what happened on the appeals? While we wait for attorney Monique Sparks to get her audio working. Monique?
Yes, on the appeals or on the trial level?
Whichever you'd like to talk about.
I would say the biggest issue is with the guard and his testimony in the punishment phase. Clearly, a big deal in death penalty cases is future dangerousness. And I believe that them bringing up that he had assaulted another inmate was something that the juries took in heavily into consideration of whether he was going to be dangerous in the future, which ultimately led to them agreeing to assess him the death penalty. And what was important about that is that there was Johnson, that was the inmate, later came out and said that the guard that testified in his trial, I believe it's Hinton, kind of goaded him into attacking Mr. Mendoza, and in fact, not goaded him, rewarded him afterwards. And so I think that testimony would have been helpful. And I know that there's arguments that wouldn't have substantially changed things, but every little thing helps in meeting that burden. And so if that was one of the things that the jury considered in regards to his future dangerousness, and that wasn't really fleshed out well, or that information, you know, that Mr. Johnson was available, I don't have any information that the defense counsel in fact spoke with them so they could, you know, cross-examine the detention officer about those things. So it left a false impression for the jury. And like I said, Mr. Johnson, the other inmate, later came and did an affidavit in providing information about that.
That's fascinating. Is that kind of thing common?
I would wouldn't say what kind of thing. I mean, the thing is this, if you're in a case like this, you leave no stone unturned, because right. you know that there's going to be, I mean, you know the battle that you're up against, right? And so as a defense attorney in a case like this, you want to kind of flesh out every single thing you can. Nothing would have hurt it. Nothing would have hurt them by trying to talk to the inmate, right? Or talk to other inmates and get other witnesses. A lot of times, even if they couldn't have, even if Johnson wasn't cooperative at the time, I'm sure other people in the jail saw the fight. So I just don't see, I can't come up with a good reason why they didn't do it. There's really no good reason when you know that the major decision is he a danger in the future? And surely if this is the kind of crime that he's up against, and then they're leaving the impression that he's fighting and aggressive in jail, then that's going to lead a jury to think that he is a future danger. So I just can't really come up with a good reason for them having, you know, for the lack of investigation.
And again, this was in the county jail before he actually was moved on. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's so, ladies, why was the bad aspect? It just seemed like he had a defense that didn't care. What do you do in that situation? Is it easy to go ahead and change midstream and get new lawyers? What do you do if you're an inmate and you're facing a death sentence and you have no funds, no type of money situations that you can, you can't pay anybody? How do you get someone to take these cases on?
I would say you speak out early and often. You speak out early and often, and at least even as a pro, even if you're represented, nothing prevents you from writing things to the court and saying, and putting things on record immediately. Like, hey, I haven't seen my lawyer in 9 months. Okay, hey, I haven't seen any evidence. Hey, I haven't talked to anybody. Hey, because you can't, when you get a court appointed, you can't choose what lawyer you want. The law doesn't allow that. However, you are entitled to effective assistance of counsel. And so if you start documenting that, and you have a court that is concerned, especially in this kind of case, about it being overturned, a court can intervene and say, hey, either, you know, the lawyer that the court has appointed gets this right, or I will appoint another lawyer. I have seen judges in Harris County, based on pro se communication from defendants, appoint a new lawyer. If somebody says, hey, I haven't seen my lawyer in 9 months, that's just that. I mean, how can you know what's going on if you don't talk to your client? If someone says, hey, I've never seen the evidence, how can they effectively assist their counsel if they've never seen the evidence against them? So I don't think anything is wrong. There's never too early, and there's not enough communication you can write and put on file with the court and put them on notice about what's going on. At some point before trial, you are going to go in front of the court, whether it be pretrial motions or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I want to just put this on the record. I haven't seen my lawyer. I don't know the evidence, and I haven't been communicated with. So if this comes up, if you get convicted, or if the judge wants to do the right thing, or is even worried about the record, whether he wants to do the right thing or not, I would think with this kind of degree of case, the judge would, out of precaution, appoint someone new if you start putting those kind of things on the record.
We often talk about jailhouse lawyers and people who are so active in their own cases and understand the law. And, well, of course, Clinton Young is certainly one of those people who understands exactly what is going on and knows so much more about the law than I do. But what type of information do people who don't know how to seek that out? Or if there's a language barrier, is there anything there to ensure that they get the proper guidance in these cases?
I would say, and I guess it depends on what county, that, like I said, I've been retained on cases or asked to get on cases after a client has filed documentation with the court, directly. And if there's a county where there is a public defender's office, or something of that nature, I would maybe reach out to that. Every county is different. I know we have public defender's offices, which our Harris County Public Defender's Office is a great office. It's we've had really good results. I don't think they handle capital work, but you know, they do have an appellate division. So if there's a county with the public defender's office, maybe reach directly out to the public defender if you're not getting any access or any success from the court. If some counties have MAC, which is a managing assigned counsel, which kind of review the lawyers. And so you can reach out to whoever the head of the MAC is or the resource attorney. Every county is kind of set up different, but I would say get it out, get it documented, get it filed, and start, you know, pumping the prime for that immediately. I you can't worry about hurting people's feelings.
Right.
Freedom is on the line.
When you're fighting for your life.
That's it.
And what I can add to that, and Monique is right, but the number of times that I've received letters from people who do not have a death sentence and think that they have to file a state writ application within a year after their conviction, and they do it without counsel, because it's hard to get counsel. I mean, I'm probably one of the very few who does everything pro bono. And so the number of times that I've received requests from people for help in their state habeas, and they have already filed a writ application pro se because they thought there was a deadline. And for me to then step in and do something on a subsequent habeas application is so much harder.
Right.
So a lot of times these people file writ applications with the help of these jail lawyers. And I mean, it's great that people educate themselves on the law. I mean, that's fantastic. I encourage everyone to do it. But to then file a habeas application pro se is, I mean, it's going to make it really hard to then, for me as an attorney, to file subsequent habeas petition, because then there's all these requirements and bars put in place that are hard to overcome.
Would you
and
say
so? Sorry, go ahead.
No, would you say that lack of good information is one of the biggest obstacles to many of these cases?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And people, you know, before a few years ago, people didn't have tablets, so they could go on LexisNexis and research case law. And I mean, I cannot tell you, like, probably 99% people that write me, and I get a lot of letters, they think they have a timeline of a year to file a state writ application, and it's just not correct. If you don't have a death sentence, that's not the deadline. And so they file pro se, and they, I mean, kind of mess up their case because they don't know how to, you can't do an investigation from a prison cell.
Right.
Unfortunately, you're going to need help from the outside. You're going to need people to talk to witnesses, like, you know, in Mendoza's case. And also in Mendoza's case, the importance of that new affidavit by that inmate becomes apparent when you look at his trial, because the jury actually sent out a juror note during his trial, and they asked for more information on that specific incident. So you see how important it could be. Had his attorneys actually investigated that incident, they could have challenged the officer. They could have put the inmate on the stand. The jury was interested in that incident. They specifically wrote a juror note asking about it. And
very
so,
interesting.
But then to remedy it 20 years later, because they did try to remedy it, but 20 years later, it's just going to be hard.
Right.
Be hard. And the courts, in his case, have said several times, you know, you filed too late, or, yeah, abuse of the writ. So you filed it 20 years after it's happened. Should have filed sooner.
Right, and of course, this did occur in 2004, so we are looking at something in Mr. Mendoza's case that, absolutely. Meryl, may I ask you if you could give us an update, please, on Clinton Young?
Yes, so he his conviction is now in a direct appeal phase. There's a deadline for his attorney to file. I'm not representing him. I know it says right here on the screen I'm defending him. I'm not. But I run this nonprofit in his name. So we help a lot of other people. And Clinton actually urged me to do that, wanted me to do that. We know we started this nonprofit and for him in 2014. But when he was released on bond, we started helping other people. So I have a lot of other cases now that I work on. And Clint has a fantastic attorney on direct appeal, which is Gary Udishin, who's doing his direct appeal. He is far more experienced than me, especially in direct appeal, because I've never done that. And so that's where Clint's case is at right now. And the deadline is somewhere in June for his attorney to file, and then the state can file. So it's going to take a few months before we hear anything about it.
Please give him our regards.
I will do that. He's listening. I know that.
Hello, Clinton. We miss you. We truly do. We are about to go over and change a little bit more and talk to our special guest. I hope you will both stay with us, counselors, so that we can get some of your informed information in there. If you are watching on our video stream, live stream on Houston Media Source, we are also, of course, being carried on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. And the live video stream should be up on our Facebook page and will be later posted onto the YouTube channel for Houston Media Source. We are seeing, as was described, a much larger presence than usual outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas, of law enforcement, which again is something a bit unusual. We have not seen that before. We have not seen the pushback that we are seeing today. And of course, the Death Row Angels and other protesters are there, and they will keep us informed. At this point in time, if I may, let me please bring in our very special guest for tonight. We are thrilled to have him. It is Demetrius Miner. He is the executive director of Conservative Concerned. It's an organization that's seeking to reform the criminal justice system and to change the death penalty. Thank you so much, Demetrius, for joining us tonight.
Hi, thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
So tell me, how did you get involved with the death penalty?
It's an excellent question. I'll take you back to the early 2000s. I found myself in Augusta, Georgia, and I was having a conversation with my pastor at the time. And the conversation was being centered around what it means to be pro-life. Now, for context, I am adopted, and I'm the son of a preacher. I'm a minister myself. So socially and spiritually, I thought I had a monopoly on what it means to be pro-life. It was an issue that I thought I was well-grounded and well-versed in. And that conversation came rather easily for me. But we approached the subject of the death penalty. And I remember asking him what his thoughts was. And he simply said this statement: it's hard to be pro-life and simultaneously pro-death. And that's when a light bulb sort of went off for me. And that's what caused me to do some more self-introspection and to make sure that I was consistently and holistically pro-life. And so that was the genesis of my journey of being anti-death penalty. I've been in this role for roughly 4 years, the role that I am in of educating and mobilizing conservatives on the issue of capital punishment, why at the very minimum, conservatives should have some grave concerns about its use.
I'm fascinated why conservatives.
Yeah.
Why are you focusing on them? Are they a receptive audience? Is it a change in complete belief system for them? Why are you focusing on conservatives specifically?
That's an excellent question. Well, first and foremost, because I am a conservative. And being a conservative, you understand what messaging and what tactics are going to work and going to resonate with that particular audience is. There are several reasons why conservatives. Number one, we see this issue as being a red state phenomenon. And what I mean by that is the fact that it's going to take conservative leaders and conservative voices to get us across the finish line, especially knowing that the bulk of the states that still use capital punishment are states that are red or have Republican leadership. Here are the reasons why they should be concerned about the use of capital punishment. Again, number one, it is a violation of pro-life principles, being pro-life, having the view of natural birth to natural death. That's number one. Number two, conservatives have an inherent distrust of government. And we have seen that government can be corrupt, government can be inept, and government can be inefficient. A government that can fail to deliver your mail on time, especially during the holiday season. A government that has proven that the COVID numbers that it has given to us and has shared with us have proven to be inaccurate. And so I asked conservatives, I said, if you don't trust the government to deliver your mail on time, if you don't trust the government to give you accurate accurate COVID numbers, if we can't trust the government to properly utilize a group chat on an app, then why would we, and I say this absent of being hyperbolic, but why would we trust the government with our life, okay? Another point is the innocence factor. There has been, not too long ago, we recently had our 200th exoneree from death row. That tells me that's 200 times the government almost got it wrong, not counting the times that the government did get it wrong. My position is this: one innocent person that's put to death is one too many. And so the capital punishment is prone to human error. It is prone to a lack of good judgment. And that is something that we should not be comfortable with. Another point is this, the fiscal component of the death penalty. It costs more to execute someone than it does for someone to serve a sentence of life without parole. And a lot of times there's this misconception that the facts are in reverse, but no, it actually costs more to administer a capital punishment sentence. And here's the reason why. It's because a capital punishment sentence is not something that is administered in an expeditious manner. A capital punishment sentence takes years and years. Why? Because you have to have a new jury, you have to have a new trial, and because of the fees that are accrued over the months and the years that take place, that piles up. And that's why the cost is so astronomical. I want to put this in context here for your audience to understand. Before the state of Maryland repealed the death penalty, they spent $185 million, close to $200 million, on five executions over a 20-year time span. Five. That is literally a handful. So we must ask ourselves these questions. What would it look like for what's being spent on the death penalty to be reallocated towards things that are actually going to be beneficial? Things as such as more support and more resources for victims, survivors, and their families. More resources for law enforcement to properly do their jobs and fulfill their roles. More resources for community entities and organizations to serve as that stopgap for violence and to prevent violence from occurring. And the conversation can definitely be more robust as to what we can, what will be, what things will be better spent on than administering a capital punishment sentence. And so for these reasons and more, is why conservatives should have grave concern over the use of the death penalty.
I want to ask you a question. On number two, you were saying that a distrust of government, especially via the conservatives in our world. But
sure.
It's an imperfect system, but why say it's the government when they are basically condemned by a jury of their peers?
Sure. Well, to that point, there's been several cases of false eyewitness testimony or false or prosecutorial misconduct that has proven to be a factor with the jury, or where certain evidence wasn't admitted into court, or where certain information was being withheld. Case in point, in Oklahoma, as I speak, there's a young gentleman on death row right now by the name of Tremaine Wood. And one of the jurors actually said that she regretted her vote because information was being withheld that she later found out was pivotal and crucial to his claim of innocence. So a lot of times we have heard about jury intimidation and the facts being withheld, which has led to many times a guilty verdict being rendered.
How does your organization work? How do you talk to people? How do you reach conservatives?
I try to reach people where they are. So by that, conservatives, just like any group of people, are not monolithic. You know, there are conservatives who are more swayed by dollars and cents and the fiscal aspect. There are pro-life conservatives and social conservatives. Then there are those who are probably more libertarian leaning, who again are just very skeptical of big government and believe that government at its finest works when it is small and when it is limited. So each audience is different, but all in all, there are certain elements that are going to resonate with different sets of conservatism, and that is the proper role of government. And if we don't trust government at administering some basic duties, then why would we be advocates and proponents of state-sanctioned violence? So it depends on who you're talking to. You know, if you're talking to a lawmaker, a conservative lawmaker, nothing moves a lawmaker more than dollars and cents. And so when we show what's being spent astronomically on the death penalty, then that raises concern, that raises suspicion. If we're talking to conservatives who are moved by faith and again, moved by pro-life convictions, then we talk about the need to be holistically pro-life. So there's various message that we can deliver to various audiences within the conservative movement. Again, it's about reaching them where they're at.
Counselors, do you have any questions for Demetrius? While we get those together, let me also add that we were going to have an interview, of course, with Jamila Hodge. She's the CEO of Equal Justice USA. And if I understand this correctly, Demetrius, well, Mr. Minor, may I say, I'm so sorry.
You can call me by my first name. I will answer.
Thank you. You all were a part of Equal Justice USA until recently. Is that correct?
That is correct. To tell you the origins of conservatives' concern, we were birthed in 2013 in March at CPAC, which stands for the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is the largest gathering of conservatives in our nation. And so that took place in March 2013. And from that, we have birthed several state chapters. We have been a part of repeals in several states. And as of a month ago, we have, from 2013 to the beginning of this year, we were a project of Equal Justice USA up until recently, where we branched off and became an independent entity.
Anything else you'd like to tell us about your organization?
Absolutely. I will encourage people to check out our resources, to check out our work and what we're involved in and the campaigns that we have going on in several states, and encourage people who are interested in partnering with us, especially financially, to please go to www.conservativesconcern.org.
Thank you so much. We do appreciate it, Mr. Miner, and Demetrius, and I know that you have other places that you needed to be today, but we thank you for taking the time. We truly do.
Thank you. Pleasure is all mine.
Again, you are listening to Execution Watch. This is a special program that we air on KPFT, simulcasted, of course, on Houston Media Source, who we are very grateful for their time and for their facilities. Let's check back in, if we may, with our Death House reporter, Linda Snyder. If we can get Linda back on the line. Linda, can you hear us? Linda. If it sounds like we have different connecting problems, it's basically because we are creating this program via Zoom, and it's the only way that we can actually bring you people into the studio with their expertise, with their knowledge, and with their firsthand observations. While we wait to get Linda back onto the line, let me go back to our panel, of course, to Monique Sparks and to Meryl Pontier, if I may. Meryl, what do you see as something that would be able to change more readily the way that people can access the legal system? If that's one of our biggest problems, how can we change that?
You mean how can we change people's access to the legal system or legal advice, support, all that stuff?
Correct.
One of the biggest positives in recent years was the tablet, where people can now look up case law and have access to LexisNexis in prison, which is great.
If you don't mind, would you please explain to some people, to our listeners, that the LexisNexis is a legal document. It's a large network that really is only available to lawyers. And you're saying that it's also available to inmates? Is that correct?
Oh, yes. So it's a database with case law.
Right.
And so every lawyer uses it to research case law on a specific topic. And so it's on the Securus tablet. And I've never seen this tablet, so I don't know. But there's an app on there, LexisNexis. And these inmates can look for case law. And I think it's restricted to only Texas case law and then U.S. Supreme Court and maybe federal. I don't think it's other states.
Right.
So that is a huge plus, because I think before that people had to go to the law library.
Yeah, you'll see the van usually comes through. Well, maybe not now, but usually the van comes through.
Oh, maybe
here.
Linda has an update. Or not.
Sorry. Linda Snyder. Let's go to Linda Snyder very quickly. Linda, can you hear us?
I guess not.
Nope, muted again. I'm sorry. Please continue, Meryl.
Yeah, that's okay. Just want to make sure there's no update. So before that, you know, especially people on death row or in solitary confinement, they could not just go and walk over to the law library and look at books. They had to ask for books, or they had to have people from the outside mail stuff in, like case law and stuff. But now they can look up things themselves, which is great. I do think there should be more attorneys who do it pro bono, and the people who do it pro bono, like, I can't take on 20 cases. It's
right.
Too many.
Right.
I could take on maybe 5 cases, and it's going to take years for me to investigate, because I don't charge my clients. And I understand not everybody can do that pro bono. You have to give up a lot to be able to do that. Because I'm never going to make a whole lot of money. But I wish there was more money available to do for us lawyers to do this stuff pro bono. And there's a lot of money in this country. I'm from Europe. And coming into this country, I know there's the United States, it's a rich country. I know there's a lot of money in here. And it's not really divided equally. And I wish there was just more funding towards, you know, representation so that attorneys like me and other attorneys, we can do this stuff pro bono, because there's so many people in prison who've been convicted and who don't have, you know, the means to pay attorneys. And people on death row, obviously, they get attorneys appointed, which is great, but not always great. It doesn't necessarily mean you get effective representation, but at least you get it paid for. But everybody who doesn't have a death sentence, they get a, yeah, they need money to pay for attorneys. Maybe Linda now has
She's allergic to seafood.
Yes.
Who's that?
Let's go to Linda. Linda Snyder, if we may, over outside of the death house. Linda, can you hear us?
Yes, the witnesses have come back and gotten in the cars now to go to the church.
Yeah, but if they hit
and,
her
plate, and that is the signal, of course, that the execution is over. This will be the first time that Melissa Mendoza will actually be able to touch Moses Mendoza as he lies in state or in his death, in his pall. Thank you, Linda. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And so ends the life of Mr. Moses Mendoza. Rest in peace, Moses. I thank everyone who has been participating in this particular discussion. Monique, do you have anything specific to add to what we've been talking about tonight?
No, it's just another, failure in our system. It's just evidence of another failure in our system. And, I will be happy when this show doesn't exist because the death penalty doesn't exist. And I guess we just kind of keep fighting.
This is the third execution here in Texas this year. Of course, earlier we had Richard Tabler and Steve Nelson. We had one stay that happened, and we're grateful for that. But this is the third execution in Texas. It's the 13th, I believe, in the nation. And we are seeing different ways for executions to be carried out. At another date, I would love to discuss with you all how these executions have been turned to firing squads and to other means other than the chemical injections, which we do here in Texas. I think that would be an interesting topic of conversation for all of us. Of course, we are going to have another scheduled execution next month. It's going to be Matthew Johnson. They have arranged that to be on Tuesday, May the 22nd, 2025. It may seem like a long time off, but not for Mr. Johnson, I'm sure, and Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing beginning at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time with our live news coverage of this. This is a very difficult topic to bring up. It's a difficult thing to talk about, that these state-sanctioned killings don't always get it right. I know they always try, but they don't always get it right. As Demetrius was telling us, there is an imperfect system in place where people are falling through the cracks, where there is not a fairness in the way that we are handing out these sentences to so many different people. So we would appreciate the fact that our founders, of course, Elizabeth Stein and Ray Hill, brought this to everyone's attention back in the Rick Perry time when there were so many executions in the state of Texas. I'd like to thank them all for all of that. So thanks, everyone. This is bringing a close to this edition of Execution Watch. As I said earlier, our next scheduled broadcast date is going to be Tuesday, May 22nd, 2025, as Texas prepares to send Matthew Johnson into the death chamber in Huntsville. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. Go to executionwatch.org to learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas. You can subscribe to our mailing list. We're happy to have you. You can also find us on Facebook. Just search Execution Watch and past shows on YouTube. Our thanks again to the entire Execution Watch crew, our legal analysts, Meryl Pontier and Monique Sparks, our reporters, Linda Snyder and Danny Allen, our video director, Mark Pirtle, technical director, Otis McClay, engineer, Howard Reynolds, announcer, Howard Reynolds, our board op at KPFT, Blue Viatoro, production assistant, Mel Peterson, and traffic, Arlene Russell. Of course, we thank our executive producer, Elizabeth Ann Stein. If you're listening live on 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Living Art. This has been a very special edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. Good night. Name. Where's all that?